Oration and Panegyric Addressed to Origen by St. Gregory Thaumaturgus. 1. For 8 years Gregory has given up the practice of oratory, being busied with the study chiefly of Roman law and the Latin language. An excellent thing has silence proved itself in many another person on many an occasion. And at present it befits myself, too, most especially, who with or without purpose may keep the door of my lips and feel constrained to be silent. For I am unpracticed and unskilled in those beautiful and elegant addresses which are spoken or composed in a regular and unbroken train, in select and well-chosen phrases and words. And it may be that I am less apt by nature to cultivate successfully this graceful and truly Grecian art. Besides, it is now 8 years since I chanced myself to utter or compose any speech, whether long or short. Neither in that period have I heard any other compose or utter anything in private, or deliver in public any laudatory or controversial orations, with the exception of those admirable men who have embraced the noble study of philosophy, and who care less for beauty of language and elegance of expression. For, attaching only a secondary importance to the words, they aim with all exactness at investigating and making known the things themselves, precisely as they are severally constituted. Not, indeed, in my opinion, that they do not desire, but rather that they do greatly desire, to clothe the noble and accurate results of their thinking in noble and comely language. Yet it may be that they are not able so lightly to put forth this sacred and godlike faculty in the exercise of its own proper conceptions, and at the same time to practice a mode of discourse eloquent in its terms, and thus to comprehend in one and the same mind, and that too this little mind of man, two accomplishments, which are the gifts of two distinct persons, and which are, in truth, most contrary to each other. For silence is indeed the friend and helpmeet of thought and invention. But if one aims at readiness of speech and beauty of discourse, he will get at them by no other discipline than the study of words and their constant practice. Moreover, another branch of learning occupies my mind completely, and the mouth binds the tongue if I should desire to make any speech, however brief, with the voice of the Greeks. I refer to those admirable laws of our sages, by which the affairs of all the subjects of the Roman Empire are now directed, and which are neither composed nor learned without difficulty. And these are wise and exact in themselves, and manifold and admirable, and, in a word, most thoroughly Grecian. And they are expressed and committed to us in the Roman language, which is a wonderful and magnificent sort of tongue, and one very aptly conformable to royal authority, but still difficult to me. Nor could it be otherwise with me, even though I might say that it was my desire that it should be. And as our words are nothing else than a kind of imagery of the dispositions of our mind, we should allow those who have the gift of speech, like some good artists, alike skilled to the utmost in their art, and liberally furnished in the matter of colors, to possess the liberty of painting their word pictures, not simply of a uniform complexion, but also of various descriptions, and of richest beauty, in the abundant mixture of flowers, without let or hindrance. 2. He essays to speak of the well-nigh divine endowments of Origen in his presence, into whose hands he avows himself to have been led in a way beyond all his expectation. But we, like any of the poor, unfurnished with these varied specifics, whether as never having been possessed of them, or, it may be, as having lost them, are under the necessity of using, as it were, only charcoal and tiles. That is to say, those rude and common words and phrases. And by means of these, to the best of our ability, we represent the native dispositions of our mind, expressing them in such language as is at our service, and endeavoring to exhibit the impressions of the figures of our mind, if not clearly or ornately, yet at least with the faithfulness of a charcoal picture, welcoming gladly any graceful and eloquent expression which may present itself from any quarter, although we make little of such. But furthermore, there is a third circumstance which hinders and dissuades me from this attempt, and which holds me back much more even than the others, and recommends me to keep silence by all means. I allude to the subject itself, which made me, indeed, ambitious to speak of it, but which now makes me draw back and delay. For it is my purpose to speak of one who has indeed the semblance and repute of being a man, but who seems to those who are able to contemplate the greatness of his intellectual caliber to be endowed with powers nobler and well-nigh divine. And it is not his birth or bodily training that I am about to praise, and that makes me now delay and procrastinate with an excess of caution. Nor again is it his strength or beauty, for these form the eulogies of youths, of which it matters little whether the utterance be worthy or not. For to make an oration on matters of a temporary and fugitive nature, which perish in many various ways, and quickly, and to discourse of these with all the grandeur and dignity of great affairs, and with such timorous delays, would seem a vain and futile procedure. And certainly, if it had been proposed to me to speak of any of those things which are useless and unsubstantial, and such as I should never voluntarily have thought of speaking of, if, I say, it had been proposed to me to speak of anything of that character, my speech would have had none of this caution or fear, lest in any statement I might seem to come beneath the merit of the subject. But now, my subject dealing with that which is most godlike in the man, and that in him which has most affinity with God, that which is indeed confined within the limits of this visible and mortal form, but which strains nevertheless most ardently after the likeness of God, and my object being to make mention of this, and to put my hand to weightier matters, and therein also to express my thanksgivings to the Godhead, in that it has been granted to me to meet with such a man beyond the expectation of men, the expectation, verily, not only of others, but also of my own heart, for I neither set such a privilege before me at any time, nor hoped for it. It being, I say, my object, insignificant and altogether without understanding as I am, to put my hand to such subjects, it is not without reason that I shrink from the task, and hesitate, and desire to keep silence. And in truth, to keep silence seems to me to be also the safe course, lest with the show of an expression of thanksgiving, I may chance in my rashness to discourse of noble and sacred subjects in terms ignoble and paltry and utterly trite, and thus not only miss attaining the truth, but even, so far as it depends on me, do it some injury with those who may believe that it stands in such a category, when a discourse which is weak is composed thereon, a discourse rather calculated to excite ridicule than to prove itself commensurate in its vigor with the dignity of its themes. But all that pertains to you is beyond the touch of injury and ridicule, O dear soul. Or, much rather, let me say, that the divine herein remains ever as it is, unmoved and harmed in nothing by our paltry and unworthy words. Yet I know not how we shall escape the imputation of boldness and rashness in thus attempting in our folly, and with little either of intelligence or of preparation, to handle matters which are weighty, and probably beyond our capability. And if indeed, elsewhere and with others, we had aspired to make such youthful endeavors in matters like these, we would surely have been bold and daring. Nevertheless, in such a case, our rashness might not have been ascribed to shamelessness, in so far as we should not have been making the bold effort with you. But now we shall be filling out the whole measure of senselessness, or rather, indeed, we have already filled it out, in venturing with unwashed feet, as the saying goes, to introduce ourselves to ears into which the divine word himself, not indeed with covered feet, as is the case of the general mass of men, and as it were under the thick coverings of enigmatical and obscure sayings, but with unsandaled feet, if one may so speak, has made his way clearly and perspicuously, and in which he now sojourns. While we, who have but refuse and mud to offer in these human words of ours, have been bold enough to pour them into ears which are practiced in hearing only words which are divine and pure. It might indeed suffice us, therefore, to have transgressed thus far, and now at least it might be but right to restrain ourselves, and to advance no further with our discourse. And verily, I would stop here most gladly. Nevertheless, as I have once made the rash venture, it may be allowed me first of all to explain the reason under the force of which I have been led into this arduous enterprise, if indeed any pardon can be extended to me for my forwardness in the matter. End of part 1.